This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Kurt Morrison, Head of ESG Advisory, and Nick Stansbury, Head of Climate Solutions. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning, Max.
Well, we're dedicating this podcast to COP27, the global summit that's currently underway. About 45,000 people from 196 countries have convened for talks on how to address the climate crisis, of course, including Kurt, who's just come back from Sharm el-Sheikh. Sonia, before we dig into the detail of the summit, let's set the scene a little. How has the macro and geopolitical context shifted the debate since COP26 last year, and why does this matter to investors?
Thank you, Max, and good morning, everyone. I think the better question is, what hasn't changed? If you recall, when COP26 started on the 13th of November 2021, we were still talking heavily about normalizing post-pandemic. We were talking about inflation being predominantly transitory because we were worried about global supply chains and the disruption that were arising from the normalization efforts around the globe. And inflation, although heading around, I just looked it up earlier, 4.5%, as I said, yes, was worrying most participants, including central bank, but it clearly wasn't as dominant a theme as it would emerge to be throughout 2022. I like to recall that at the end of 2021, the 10-year Treasury was at 1.5% and all major equity indices were at record highs. That's how we started 2022, and fast forward to COP27. And as I said before, everything has changed. The inflationary narrative is the dominant driver for global markets, because what we have been seeing is not only that the debate around transitory has morphed into a realization that some of the structural inflationary drivers are far stickier and are coming in far higher than originally anticipated. And clearly that has led to a fundamental shift in global monetary policy and one of the most aggressive tightening cycles in the history of central banking. In the US, it is the most aggressive tightening since the 80s, and it clearly is the most aggressive tightening cycle since the setup of the ECB. So that clearly now has shifted the debate on growth as well. We're looking towards a recession, clearly starting in the winter here in Europe, and there's still forecast for a no longer softish landing, but clearly the potential for a recession in the US, potentially in the second half of next year. Geopolitics, the final part of the debate, has shifted as well quite dramatically, obviously, with the invasion of Ukraine earlier this year. And that, I think, leads us squarely to the topic of COP27, because clearly the global energy crisis that has unfolded since the invasion of Ukraine has led not only to a full-blown cost of living crisis with fundamental and very severe impacts on consumers, particularly here in Europe. It has raised the question around energy security, and it has definitely changed the balance and the narrative for most governments as they have to balance the idea around energy security with the proposed net zero pathways and obviously their desire to tackle climate change. So a lot going on, and why it matters for investors. Clearly, first and foremost, as I've just said, inflation is the dominant driver of markets, and central bank policy and the level of monetary tightening has already led to some stresses emerging throughout the global financial system. And we have to assume that there's more pain to come simply because capital is no longer freely available to most market participants. But given that the topic today is COP27, I think that the most important one is obviously sustainable investing and how the narrative has shifted because of the energy crisis emerging, and particular energy security being such an important factor. Now, there's two experts here in the room, so I will leave it there, because I think that's the questions we definitely want to find an answer to throughout this podcast.
Right, yes. So everything has changed since last year for investors and the world. And that is a great point at which to bring Kurt into the conversation. Kurt, what have been the most significant developments at the summit thus far? And what do you expect to achieve when it concludes?
Mm. Well, Thanks, Max. I spent 4 days at the COP, and it was extremely intensive. And I want to share with you 5 key insights we got from the meetings we had. The first one, following what Sonia was saying, ESG and climate is no longer just an add-on or an isolated area where asset managers are operating and the real economy is trying to achieve net zero. It's now in the realm of the geopolitics as well as the geoeconomics. One example of that, at the COP27, we saw emerging markets, key emerging markets, is this from Indonesia to Kenya, arguing and defending a compensation fund on climate. That's the first time we see something like that. So countries are understanding and nations are understanding the value of ESG and climate, but they also understand that the G20 is responsible for 80% of the greenhouse emissions. So there is an issue in terms of a country's trying to achieve their NDCs, which is their targets on climate based on the Paris Agreement. But you cannot compare the greenhouse emissions from UK versus Bhutan. You cannot. And countries are realizing this and they're mobilizing their political forces through regulations, pressing international organizations, donors, agencies that sometimes maintain substantial support on their economy to change and drive change on climate on their countries. The best example of that is also Pakistan. Pakistan was directly impacted on the floods this year, and a lot of countries are facing the same situation, which creates a pressure on developed markets to address not only ESG issues, but also how the global community will tap ESG focus on climate in a much more global way. The second one is connected with this. It is the rise of a global green economy. And when I say that, it's not too much about on the real economy, it's much more about monetary policy as well as a trade. Give 2 examples. IMF is currently assessing instruments to integrate biodiversity as well as climate issues into global monetary policy. This would trigger down to national central banks. So we might see in the next 3 years changes on how central banks will operate. The impact of that, we still have to look at. The second part is on trade, and that's something interesting we see ahead. The World Trade Organization is planning for the first time embedding issues on climate, on their regulatory and policies on trade. The impact of this in the value chain and supply chains are massive. Third, it's not only tracking the carbon. Now, when you look at the G20, the topic on transitioning finance makes sense. It's how you change South Africa or Australia or even India in moving from coal to a more active way in addressing renewables. But for 100 countries around, or more than 150 countries, it's not too much on transitioning finance anymore. It's about on adaptation, resilience, and mitigation. So it's less about renewables, it's less about changing, but much more in adapting infrastructure to the changes in the economy. Third, there are plenty of opportunities in emerging markets, but I want to identify 7 issues that COP and the key specialists identified. The first one, to invest in emerging markets, we're talking about foreign exchange risk. Second, political and regulatory issues. Third, we're talking about integration of ESG factors in the real economy. So how business integrates ESG factors that translate into the data in which Nick, Sonia can operate to invest. Fourth, we're looking at good quality of asset in those countries. This includes proper maturity and ticket size. We're looking at knowledge on ESG as well, both at the government level and as well as the company level. So it seems to us it's a great opportunity, but lots of things to do. The last part, Max, is about ESG knowledge. Until 5 years ago, it was quite easy just to be part of membership of an organization saying we are committed to achieve something. COP27 gave us a quick and short answer. It's not about words, it's about actions. And actions require deep understanding on ESG factors. And I would pause here.
Thanks. Right, well, that's a great comprehensive overview. Thank you, Kurt. And I think we'll return to the question of emerging markets versus developed markets later on the call. In a minute, could you perhaps give us a flavour of what COP27 was like on the ground? So how did you spend your time day to day?
I was telling to Sonia, in 4 days, spoke in two panels at the same day. I just finished one panel at 4, talking about emerging markets. I run to another panel at the same time on impact investing. I had 22 meetings from IMF, European Investment Bank, name it. So I'm still digesting what COP was, but I'm sure I can provide a better input in a couple of days once I actually write down my notes on the topic.
Good. Looking forward to that. Let's turn to Nick now. Nick, what are your central scenarios for decarbonization, and could progress at this summit shift your underlying assumptions?
It's probably worth stepping back about and thinking about the numbers, because the numbers are pretty stark when we think about scenarios and when we think about the speed of progress. So broadly speaking, to get us down to something consistent with net zero 2050, we need to see global emissions fall something like 7% a year, every single year between now and 2050. The only time we've ever come anywhere close to that was in the depths of the COVID crisis, when from peak to trough, everyone stayed home, the skies had no planes in them, everyone's cars stayed in the driveway. That's about what we saw peak to trough during COVID. We've obviously completely undone that. And we're probably looking, in our view, sort of cold, objective look at the data, at emissions being broadly flat to rising very slightly, probably for the next 2 to 3 years. And unfortunately, that problem compounds, right? So every year that we don't do anything means that the speed at which we have to see emissions fall thereafter gets harder and harder. And 7% is already, we think, sitting somewhere at the sort of feasibility frontier. So going much faster than 7% is pretty challenging, which means if we wait even 36 months before we start to see the emissions rolling over globally, we're probably starting to rule out the best outcomes consistent with, say, 1.5. So with that sort of cold, depressing, objective look at the data, what are our expectations? Well, we haven't seen out of COP27 really material progress towards some of the key policies, sort of standing head and shoulders above everything else, is putting an effective price on carbon. And therefore, we would expect emissions to stay probably broadly flat this year, and probably broadly flat the year after. So that if we were to continue on that sort of trajectory, that would take us probably to something of the order of 2.5 to 2.8 degrees of global warming by 2100, even if we were to start decarbonizing reasonably aggressively in the 2030s. So that remains our unfortunate base case. We can see, even today, very feasible, very economic pathways to much better outcomes.
So a grim picture looking ahead then, Nick. As Sonia notes, the discourse has definitely changed following the war in Ukraine. In your view, are decarbonisation and energy security mutually exclusive?
So we don't think so at all. And we don't think you need to focus on one, not the other. And we definitely agree that if you focus only on energy security and ignore decarbonisation, you'll end up with skewed outcomes, and the same if you focus on the other. But that doesn't mean that they're mutually exclusive. They're just considerations that have to be considered in parallel, if that makes sense. And so why do we think that? Well, we think that, first of all, because when we analyse the causes of the problem we currently see ourselves in, which is, you know, energy security or energy insecurity writ large, which is what we see around us today, we don't see that that's been caused in some way by decarbonisation. Actually, when we look at the data, what we think it's been caused by is underinvestment. So some sort of raw data on that. Versus 2015, spending in the oil and gas industry has fallen by something like 60 to 65%. So that's the sort of level of spending in upstream oil and gas that you would expect to see if we were on track for a net zero 1.5 degree outcome, which clearly we're not on track for in terms of demand. So the oil and gas industry is investing pretty much what you would expect them to be investing if we were heading towards that net zero outcome. But at the same time, we're investing something like a third as much as we would need to be investing in global clean energy if we were on track for that scenario. So if we take money away from both of our engines of the energy system, what we end up with is an energy security problem. Do we solve that problem by taking more money away from here? No, we don't think so. What we need to do is we clearly need to significantly accelerate the amount of capital we put into the energy system. And that is, for us, the way out of the energy crisis hole we find ourselves in today. And we think it would be a mistake to turn our backs as investors or as society from the cheapest and most secure sources of energy can, which is low carbon energy in its broadest sense.
Right. Well, Sonia, staying with the theme of investment in the energy system, calls for divestment from fossil fuels continue to grow, while accepting that some clients cannot invest in energy companies. Why do we as a firm prefer corporate engagement with the threat of consequences over blanket divestments?
I think my answer very much links to what Nick has just said, right? I mean, it's very clear that the debate so far has been very emotive, very black and white, and probably not with the sufficient level of understanding of the very delicate nature of transitioning the global energy system within the shortest period of time. And as Nick has highlighted, I think we don't have a lot of historic evidence that we've been very successful in doing so. And it's clear that obviously the motive behind the call for divestment is a pure one. It's a very logical one. You say, okay, as soon as I divest from oil and gas, surely we will then invest in renewables. And miraculously, we will support with that the transition. But as we now know, it's not as straightforward and not as black and white. And as Nick has very clearly just demonstrated, it does require an ongoing investment in both, obviously, the decarbonization and investment in renewable energy, while at the same time making sure that we can still switch the lights on. And for that, we need a reliable energy source to do so. I would hope that on the back, obviously, of the current experience, COP27, at least the debate is shifting and moving to the next level, that there's greater honesty about the holistic and global nature of the problem statement that unfortunately does require, to a large extent, at least a definition on a global basis before you then can take away what a national plan, i.e. a European plan, even a German plan, a UK plan and path to net zero should look like. And how companies, again, that operate globally can align to that transition pathway. It's been too narrow until now, and probably not with all the necessary ingredient. Nick has mentioned the carbon price or a carbon tax earlier. Again, we are still, I think, struggling to quantify the global problem statement to an extent that would allow that level of transparency across, obviously, all the market participants and stakeholders. And this is why I hope very clearly we say divestment will not solve the problem, because it is just too simplistic to assume that with us removing capital from one part of the equation, and it will not necessarily end up on the other side. And as such, we believe that, point one, oil and gas is part of the transition and is part of the longer term solution. But clearly, there is a pathway for the oil and gas sector that companies need to consider and need to align themselves to. That's the importance. And again, I can only achieve this if I remain and keep my seat at the table and have the credibility in terms of our understanding and knowledge of the sector, the problem statement, to sit in front of those companies to say, this is what we would like you to do. We are here to support and help, but we are a critical friend on that journey. And divestment remains at least a consequence if we are not seeing the relevant action that we need to see. And I think Nick very clearly outlined there is dramatic changes that we will need to see. But as I said, divestment will not help us to accelerate that pathway.
That's really interesting. So clearly the debate requires nuanced answers, and that seat at the table is critical if we are to keep the lights on as well. Well, Kurt, turning back to COP, what has given you most cause for optimism from the summit and most cause for concern?
That's a really good question. I think the first one is and resonating to what Sonia was saying, like this quote from Fahin from JP Morgan DFI. She was telling me, if you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go further, you go together. Divesting, you're going alone. Be sitting on the table and working together with your investees, you can go further. and it's all about collaboration. I think the COP27, what we saw there is that the challenges in climate, and as Nick was saying, it's a kind of the worst case scenario we're leading to, depending on the circumstances, is saying we cannot do this work alone. It's about collaboration. And when I say collaboration and what the UN, IMF, PRI, hundreds of organizations there, everyone was sharing the same quorum and saying it's about working together. Now, how you work together, and that's the devil, is in the details here, goes to the second part, there is no size fit all. So on COP26, 25th, 24th, was always saying there is a magic pill that if you go to this road, being a member of X and Y action, we will achieve the solution. Well, in COP27 is saying, actually not. The problems in certain emerging countries are not the same thing in other countries. And sub-Sahara issues are not the same thing in Central America. The issues in the US are not the same thing as issues in the UK. So the words we're looking at in COP is adaptation, customization, bespoke of investments, approach and engage with companies, and addressing how lobbying and policies will be designed. And that it shows the difficulties, but also the opportunity in creating impact with stakeholders at the local and regional level. And the third one is about actions. So very interesting to see that the Egyptian COP presidency, that were very clear, is about actions. There is no time for talk, it's about actions. So, and combining those three factors is much more how we work together to find the right action that is designed for a specific purpose in a specific sector, a specific region, a specific country, a specific industry. But I think the challenge is finding the right tone. As Nick was saying, one of the issues we don't have at this moment, a material policies and at the COP. And I think that's a very important topic. There are policies, but not a material policy that says, okay, that's the direction of travel. And I think it's an opportunity here as well as a challenge. So I think it was a great shock in terms of getting a little bit and a realistic view of what the COP28 will be, the COP29 will be, and luckily the next COPs ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. I like that quote about going further, and I look forward to our podcast next year about COP28. Nick, Kurt touched on this earlier just now. Why do you believe the climate battle will be won or lost in emerging markets?
Yeah, thanks, Jess. Let's take two countries. One we know really well, one we know probably really pretty badly. So take the UK. In the UK, we've got something like 70 million people. And over the past decade, we have shrunk our emissions at a compound rate of, roughly speaking, 4% a year. So we're left with a global emissions footprint after all of that decarbonisation of about 300 million tonnes out of a global carbon footprint of about 50 billion tonnes. What we do in the UK is just irrelevant. Really, when it comes to decarbonisation, when it comes to meeting the world's climate goals, whether 300 million is 300 million, 400 million, 150 million, really it doesn't matter. Mm. Right? So just the sheer scale, right? Point number one. Point number two is our relative consumption of both carbon and energy. So let's now take India. Instead of decarbonizing at 4% a year over the past decade, India has seen, for all sorts of very expected and sort of reasonable reasons, their emissions grow at about 4% a year. So not down 4, up 4. And still, despite that, they use something like a tenth of the carbon that we do on a per capita basis. But that still leaves them emitting 2.5 billion tonnes compared to our tiny, tiny, tiny little 300 million. But they do that from a position of using on a per capita basis less than a fifth of the energy that we do here. So to put that in context, in the UK, each of us uses about as much energy as you would use if you took a typical 3-kilowatt electric heater. Many of us will have these in our homes now because it's getting a bit chilly. You plug that heater in, you leave it on, you forget, you leave it on. Some of us will have done that for 24 hours. And that is equivalent to your entire day's energy consumption to leave that heater plugged in for a day. In India, you could leave that heater plugged in for 4 or 5 hours and zip, that'd be it. So you'd completely used up your budget. So the challenge, the reason why climate decarbonization is all about emerging markets, it's not won or lost emerging markets, it's all about emerging markets, is where are there going to be more people rather than fewer people by 2050? There's going to be more people in India. In the UK, not really so clear. Where are they going to be unless we do something radical, more emissions on a per capita basis? Well, it's going to be India. And where are we still going to be seeing energy consumption growing? Well, it's going to be India. Climate change, decarbonisation, this battle, this is not mostly about emerging markets, a little bit about developed markets. It is all about emerging markets and not really at all about developed markets. So that's why we think this so strongly. This is a question of Asia. This is a question of sub-Saharan Africa. This is a question of emerging markets. That is where the climate outcome that the world realises is going to be determined more than any other factor.
Well, thanks, Nick, for that important perspective that I think really brings the challenge to life. Sonia, we covered a lot of ground today in a really insight-laden conversation. What are the key takeaways for investors, and is there anything you'd like to add?
I think it's very clear from everything we've discussed today is that the level of uncertainty is at a point of maximum input and impact on markets. And this is not just the climate debate, but clearly we have now a level of understanding around the consequences of not capturing the risks and the opportunities around climate change just as a placeholder for the broader sustainability context. And that's just part of the equation. This has to be placed in context of the dramatic changes in the inflationary backdrop, the shift in monetary policy, the expected recession that will hit us either throughout the winter or early next year, and obviously the implication on markets. Now, when it comes to markets, then clearly 22 has already priced a lot of that negative news into valuation levels. We have seen dramatic shifts across equities and bonds, and we always have to remind ourselves, obviously, about the implication that it had on the bond equity correlation. And for most investors, that probably has been a first to see both equities and bonds move in the same direction, and as such, obviously leading to quite negative returns across the board. I think going forward, it is clear that with everything that is going on, we have to assume that expected returns will be lower. There will be an implication of the shift in interest rates on relative valuation levels, because we should not forget that we have been operating against the backdrop of the most benign monetary policy environment over decades. And as such, obviously, a move away will have implications on equity risk premium, illiquidity premium, and as such, asset allocation. Markets have overreacted. There have been, obviously, there have been market movements that potentially already offer an opportunity set to investors, but being very mindful that volatility will remain elevated for the foreseeable future until we see greater clarity around where peak inflation is, peak rates are, and where we will see the geopolitical situation heading. These are the very key ingredients that we will be focusing on over the next couple of months, potentially quarters. But I think it is worth starting to look at the broader context and to look for opportunities out there. Structural drivers and themes will be a key ingredient, because the shifts that are underway clearly will create a lot of opportunity. And I think that was clear from a lot of the contributions we've heard today.
Thanks, Sonia. That's very clear. 2022, a year to forget for investors, and we should expect heightened volatility going forward. Well, finally, I'd just like to ask everyone in the room what you've been watching, reading or listening to. And let's go around the table. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've been watching a show on Apple TV called Tehran, all about Mossad spies in Iran. And it's a real nail biter, very, very compelling. Late night TV watching. Nick, over to you.
Well, rather like when there's a green salad for dinner, you don't feel terribly hungry. So my reading material is Greta Thunberg's new climate book, which has been sitting on my bedside table waiting to be picked up and read. A little bit like the Green Summer, I haven't quite had the appetite to dive into it yet, but it is there, and I will next time you ask me, Max, I will say I've read that.
We look forward to hearing your review. Sonia?
On a much lighter note, and in the context of the quite heavy material we've discussed today in all the doom and gloom, we went with the family to the cinema to watch Ticket to Paradise, which is a George Clooney, Julia Roberts movie. Very, very entertaining, and obviously the two normally are fabulous together in films.
Great, thank you. And Kurt?
Well, I have two things. Great podcast, Slow Mo. It's from Mo Gabbat. It's a Google senior executive. And what he talks about a lot on the trends on artificial intelligence. And if we think climate is an issue, be prepared for tech in the future. And another interesting topic, following what Sonia was saying, I'm looking forward to see the next season of Succession.
Oh, yeah, that's a great show. Good. We've got a really good mix of recommendations then for our listeners. I think that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Nick and Kurt, for your time today. Thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in December, when Sonia will be joined by Will Riley, Emil van den Heiligenberg and Howie Lee to assess the outlook for 2023. In the meantime, you can read our recent collection of research on sustainability themes titled To COP and Beyond on our website, and you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the Elgin blog and here, of course, on Elgin Talks.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.